Blog Talk Radio.
From the far reaches of the known universe, we are proud to present Brother Harold Muhammad, soldier, scientist, scholar, Blog Talk Radio's finest, not so mad science, on Black Hole Radio.
Assalamu alaikum, and welcome to tonight's edition of Not So Mad Science here on the Black Hole Radio Network. And I'm your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here coming to you live from the city of Detroit. Just because Berry Gordy took Motown to L.A. does not mean Detroit has lost its soul. Today is February 7th, 2017, in what I like to call the Trumpian era. We're continuing our conversation and our discussion into, can science prove the existence of a living, real God? I invite you all, dear brothers and sisters, supporters, naysayers, agreeers, disagreeers, to call in and give your opinion and give your position on this, in my estimation, this exciting subject. Last week, we left off with giving the corresponding information of the structure of an atom and how that atom authenticates and validates the existence of a consciousness and a thinking being. We're going to step away from that portion of this discussion momentarily to give some other corresponding data. To that end, I want to share some words from Dr. Neil Tyson deGrasse. There's a book titled The Handy Space Answer Book. And in the foreword of that book, Dr. Tyson says this: human wonderment has always turned to the mysteries of space and our place in the universe. Today, we are able to define the essential characteristics of our universe as never before, though we have much yet to discover. In part, I agree with Dr. Tyson's assessment. But there's a huge and a vast void with which I disagree with him in his foreword. He gives implication that we are more adept or more advanced today than we were yesterday. Are we? And if so, were the ancients, our ancestors, our predecessors, those wise ones who came before us, were they less capable of validating their existence via sciences and higher understanding and higher learning with sciences, and their relationship with their concept and idea of God. With that said, I want to quote once again from this book, the Handy Space Answer Book, some of the constants that are considered in today's science. We are told that how did cosmology begin to accurately understand our place in the universe? It is not until the publication of what is called in French the De Revolutionibus Orbem Colosseum, or in English, The Revolution of the Heavenly Spheres, in 1543 by Polish astronomer Nicholas Copernicus, did what is called the heliocentric model of the solar system receive widespread attention. Is this true? And did man have to wait until 1543 for that idea and that concept to exist? What is called the heliocentric view of the universe, simply stated, is the understanding of the present day solar system as we understand it today, where the Earth revolves around the sun. I submit to you that our ancestry had this discussion with respect to the universe thousands of years prior to the existence of a man called Nicholas Copernicus. I submit that it was pre-600 BC that the concept and the idea of the universe and man's relationship via the sciences to God existed in what is termed the George G.M. James in his book Stolen Legacy. It is suggested and validated that the Egyptian mystery system taught this very concept then. It was called the doctrine of universal flux. Now, this flux, in terms of the Egyptian mystery system, refers to the structure and nature of the atom. When we look, as we discussed last week and the week before, an atom is a bundle of energy, a ball of light, composed of many balls of light. Its base structure is a proton with a positive charge, commingled in a relationship of marriage with a neutron, which has no charge, circumnavigated by an electron with a negative charge. This bundle, this ball of energy, can be considered in the terminology in the Egyptian mystery system as flux. This doctrine of the universal flux says There is no static being and no unchanging element. Change is the Lord of the universe. The underlying element of the universe is fire. But fire in the language of that time is not the fire that you think you're looking at today when you light a match. Fire interpreted in that language is electricity. And as we have discussed in previous programs over the last 3 to 4 years of Not So Mad Science, we know that electricity is the highest form of fire and the match is the lowest. In this flux, the change is not at random, but uniform, orderly, and cyclic. That is an accurate description of an atom. Thus, the heavenly fires are transmuted successfully into vapor, water, and earth. What are the three stages of existence? Vapor or a gas. Water or earth, solid, liquid, or gas, solid, liquid, or gas, the three stages of matter with an atom. This flux, it contains the elements both of the old and new. At any given moment in the process, consequently, where night ends, their day begins. Where summer begins, their spring ends. Where mortal life ends, their spiritual life begins. So the idea and the concept of the relationship of science and God was consistent and one with the ancients and not completely understood up until this very day with what is called modern science. Are we really, truly that far advanced? Or are we just catching up to ourselves finally today? It also consists, this flux, in the generation which results from the union of opposites, a doctrine later to be found in Plato and Socrates 300 to 400 years after the fact. Hence, we observe that the union of male and female produces organic life, and that sharp and flat notes produce harmony. That is the relationship between the proton, the neutron, and the electron, which combine together to form that first atom of life. It was Dr. Amit Goswami, a PhD scholar, who wrote a book called The Self-Aware Universe: How Consciousness Creates the Material World. And he says this: today in physics, we face a great dilemma. In quantum physics, the new physics, we have found a theoretical framework that works. It explains myriad laboratory experiments and more. Quantum physics has led to such tremendously useful technologies as transistors, lasers, and superconductors, yet we cannot make sense of the mathematics of quantum physics without suggesting an interpretation of experimental results that many people can look upon as paradoxical, even impossible. Therefore, he says, behold the following quantum properties. A quantum object, for example, an electron, can be at more than one place at the same time in quantum physics. A quantum object cannot be said to manifest in ordinary space-time reality until we observe it as a particle. A quantum object ceases to exist here and simultaneously appears in existence over there. We cannot say it when through the intervening space. A manifestation of one quantum object caused by our observation simultaneously influences its correlation twin object, no matter how far apart they are. Thus, we cannot connect quantum physics with experimental data without using some schema of interpretation, and interpretation depends on the philosophy we bring to bear on the data. The philosophy that has dominated science for centuries under Eurocentric theology. And I'm terming it that way because we're looking at it through the eye of Greek philosophy, the Johnny-come-latelys to the scientific world, because most of the scientific discoveries, most of the scientific institutions of learning and so forth are named via the advent of Greek philosophy. The philosophy that has dominated science for centuries, physical or material realism, assumes that only matter consisting of atoms or ultimately elementary particles is real. All else are secondary phenomena of matter, just a dance of the constituent atoms. This worldview is called realism because objects are assumed to be real and independent of subjects, us, or how we observe them. In my mind, my words now, the notion, however, that all things are made of atoms is an unproven assumption. It is not based on any direct evidence for all things. When the new physics confronts us with a situation that seems paradoxical from the perspective of material realism, we tend to overlook the possibility that the paradoxes may be arising because of the falsity of our unproven assumptions. We tend to forget that a long-held assumption does not thereby become a fact. And we often even resent being reminded that it is just an assumption. I say that because of this. In earlier discussions, we looked at the post or pre-Big Bang condition of what the universe was or had been at that time. It is in that primordial soup, the stuff, as referred to by the most honorable Elijah Muhammad, that first atom of life called itself into existence. Let's stop there. How? We're going to come back to this word flux again. That paradoxical condition that Newtonian physics, quantum physics cannot qualify, quantify, theorize, or subject to any experimentation. What produced that first atom of life? Was it chance? And what would the odds be that something can pull together that proper recipe to pull together that first atom of life? I don't believe those kind of odds can be calculated. What can be calculated is that something called those 10 million pieces into existence to come together in that primordial triple darkness, which was absent of life, light, and matter. That inert soup lacking purpose and function. I submit that that missing piece that gives concreteness to what becomes that new science, that old-timey religion, so to speak, that we don't know of yet today. The idea, the thought, the will to exist, the will to survive, the will to be. Thusly, I am. It is in that combination of things that the Big Bang becomes a functioning concept. That first atom of life went to war with the darkness that surrounded it. It was the all of all looking to survive. Now, how do we know this is true? Do we need some megalithic combination of numbers and equations to prove this out to be so? No. The evidence of the science and the existence of God at that time is proven over every single day. Doctors who are obstetricians, witnesses, mothers who are pregnant with child are subjected to it. And fathers who are the caretakers ensure its growth. It's called a baby. We see this process lived out on a routine basis, yet we have disconnected ourselves from the science of that process and have overlooked the recreation of the Big Bang every time a child is born. Sperm mixed with ovum ignites and becomes explosive. A ball of energy from a single atom of life, folding and revolving and revolving in and within itself. That first atom of life. Revolve and evolve in its spherical, elliptical nature, 360 to the 360 degree power. 360 degrees to the power of 360. He, that mind, that will revolve and evolve in the egg or the golden egg of life in all directions simultaneously, because there was no restriction on the mind that conceived itself. That ball of energy, that power, that proton coming into self-existence destroyed everything around it. It is suggested that it was a period of 300 million years for it to cool enough that it did not destroy the surrounding environment so that other things could come together to form that neutron or that electron to revolve around it. If we want to consciously look at the relationship between man and woman, we need only look at the structure of an atom. What is the structure and nature of the family? Father, who is the power, the representative, the vicegerent of God in that family structure relationship. He is the proton. He is the force and power muted and mitigated by the calming presence of his neutron, that non-charged force called woman, which allows that electron to circumnavigate around itself, that inner core of power and nurturing, lest it be destroyed by the proton at its core. That electron, which has the negative charge, which clings in its circumnavigational loop around the nucleus of the atom. We need only look at the basic human family. Children circumnavigate their parents until such time as with electrons in their relationship with the atom jump to another layer, another shell, transmuting the original atom into something else. Instead of one proton, one neutron, one electron, you now have two electrons, then three, then four, then five. With each generation, that atom transmutes into something else. But let's continue. The question is there an alternative to the philosophy of material realism? Material realism strains unsuccessfully, notwithstanding its computer models, to explain the existence of our mind, especially the phenomenon of casually potent self-consciousness. What's consciousness? The material realist tries to shrug away the question by answering cavalierly that it doesn't matter. If, however, we take all the theories that the conscious mind constructs, including the ones that negate it, with any seriousness, consciousness does in fact matter. What is consciousness? Consciousness is the root mind of God, shared with us as the children of that original root mind. Since René Descartes divided reality into two separate realms, mind and matter, many people have tried to rationalize the casual potency of conscious minds within Cartesian dualism. Well, Brother Harold, what the hell does that mean? Science presents compelling reasons to doubt that a dualistic philosophy is tenable. or possible or even exist. There is but one philosophy and one mind. In order for the worlds of mind and matter to interact, they must exchange energy. Yet we know that the energy of the material world remains constant. Surely then there is only one reality. But here's the catch 22. If the one reality is material reality, consciousness cannot exist except as an anomalous epiphanon. Two big words back to back. Basically saying they can't figure it out. So the question there is this. Is there a monistic alternative to material realism where mind and matter are integrally part of one reality? According to Amit Goswami, he says the alternative that he proposes in his book is monistic idealism, the one idea. This philosophy is monistic as opposed to dualistic, and it is dual idealism because ideas, not to be confused with ideals, and the consciousness of them are considered to be the basic elements of reality. Matter is considered to be secondary. In other words, instead of positing that everything, including consciousness, is made of matter, this philosophy posits that everything, including matter, exists in and is manipulated from consciousness. Note that the philosophy does not say that matter is unreal, but that the reality of matter is secondary to that of consciousness, which itself is the ground of all being. It is the idea, the will, and the desire to be that brings things into existence. Which makes me go to another book. This book is titled Message to the Black Man in America by the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad, the eternal leader of the Nation of Islam. He says in his book, is God a spirit or a man? He asked the question. In the second paragraph on page 6, he says the following. Habakkuk uses the pronoun he in reference to God. This pronoun he is only used in the case when we refer to a man or boy or something of the male sex. Are we living in a material universe or a spirit universe? We are material beings and live in a material universe. Would not we be making ourselves fools to be looking forward to see that which cannot be seen, only felt? Where is our proof of such a God, spirit, to teach that God is other than man? It is due to our ignorance of God, or you are one deceived by the devil, whose nature is to mislead you into the knowledge of God. What is he saying? This book, Message to the Black Man, written in 1965. And this book, The Self-Aware Universe, How Consciousness Creates the Real World, a book of physics by Dr. Amit Goswami, written in, oh, what do we have here? 1993, though one is written in a more scientific and higher language, seems to concur and to agree with the very simple language of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad in his book written in 1965. But here's the rub. This man, Elijah Muhammad, doesn't have a PhD in physics, philosophy, or world religions. But this man, Amit Goswami, does. And he's a world-renowned physicist. It is also consistent with the language used by Dr. Tyson. Let's quote his name properly here. Dr. Neil Tyson, who is currently the resident director of the Hayden Planetarium at the Museum of Natural History in New York. Where he wrote the foreword to the book, The Handy Space Answer Book, which was written in 1998. How does this man, having no letters, know this? And these men studied all these years in institutions of higher education and learning, discover this through their research. How did those who are considered the ancients, our predecessors, our ancestors, know this 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 years ago? The language, though being different, its context and meaning is the same and consistent. Can science prove the existence of God? I'm just going to have to put it out there. God proved the existence of the sciences by using science to produce the material world that we live in that is ruled by our conscious mind. As a man thinketh, so is he. I think, therefore I am. There's nothing we see in the material world that did not start out first as an idea, a thought, a projection, a spirit in the mind of a person before it was given life in a physical form that you see. Man wanted to fly like a bird. Though he did not have the physical form and structure to do so, he made an airplane. It was an idea. James Brown did a song called This is a Man's World. And in that song he says, man made the car to travel over the road. Man makes what man needs to accomplish the end that man wants. Who does that? God. I create, manufacture, and produce that which I need to accomplish the goal that I intend. And to that end, it is my consciousness that gives form to the material world. We are now 10 minutes past the hour of 7 here on Not So Mad Science on the Black Hole Radio Network. We're going to take a very, very, very small musical break while we tend to some personal business. And we'll be right back to continue our discussion. Can science validate the existence of God? We'll be right back.
Building.
Welcome back, welcome back. This is Not So Mad Science with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. We're going to begin to start winding down this segment of Not So Mad Science. But as we do so, I want to share some of the scientific terminology, theory, and projections that we're coming from. Because next week, we're going to get deep into terminology and how that terminology is nothing but scriptural and spiritual language rewritten and giving a so-called scientific framework to exist. So with to that end, let's look at this. What is a black hole? And as you begin to look at that to answer it for yourself, you're going to wonder, what the heck does that have to do with science explaining the existence of God? I ask your indulgence that you bear with me. Black holes may well be the strangest and one of the most mysterious elements. I'm not going to say thing. I'm going to call it an element in the cosmos. In addition to being a favorite subject of science fiction screenwriters, a black hole is a place where space and time meet and stretch out for infinity. Black holes are impossible to see, given the context of modern day science as it is now. The technology does not yet exist or is yet unknown or undiscovered by today's science to allow a visual of a living black hole. But the math proves their existence. We cannot see them, yet black holes may account for 90% of the content of the visible universe. Simply put, a black hole is all that remains of a massive star that has used up its nuclear fuel and collapsed under its own gravitational force into a single point. It is at this point, called the singularity, where pressure and density are infinite. When anything, any object, or even light get too close to a black hole or this singularity, it gets pulled in and stretched into infinity and remains trapped forever. Remember now, this is a concept. It is not an absolute. This concept can be understood as it is being given by looking at the effects of gravity on known objects. In order to break free of the Earth's gravitational forces, a spaceship has to travel at the speed of at least 7 miles per second. It would have to travel much faster, at least 37 miles per second, if you were doing the same thing on Jupiter. And at 380 miles per second to break free of the sun. Thus, if an object were big and dense enough, A spaceship would have to go faster than the speed of light to escape from its gravitational attraction of the black hole. According, once again, to modern day technology as it stands now, that is impossible because it is believed that nothing travels faster than the speed of light. A black hole is considered to be an object of this kind. Which begs the question, if a black hole is considered to be a collapsed star, how is that black hole formed to end up as a black hole? A star must be at least two or three times the mass of our star, called the sun. Any star will collapse once its nuclear fuel is used up. The reason is that the force of the nuclear fusion process pushing outward from the star's core balances its immense gravity. An average mass star like the sun will end up as a white dwarf, a star five to eight times the mass of the sun will explode to produce a supernova, shedding much of its mass and end up as a densely packed neutron star. A star 10 to 40 times the mass of the sun will produce a gravitational collapse so complete that after the supernova, only a black hole remains. As a giant star collapses, its mass gets so concentrated that the force of gravity becomes completely overpowering. The collapsed star's surface, called the event horizon, becomes the point of no return. Anything crossing the event horizon gets drawn in and cannot escape. What is the function? What is the purpose of a black hole? Since we know that stars do not live forever and they do collapse, is there a relative relationship between what we see without to what we see within? These are the things that we need to begin to look at if we are to understand our relationship with God and who God is and why God is. Because there is a why. How do we know that there's a why? Because he said, I am. I am is a distinct and determined desire to do. Okay? What is the function and purpose of that black hole? We're not going to posit an answer right now, but it's something I want you to think about because next week we're going to look at application. The next question would be, has anybody found a black hole? Recently, astronomers have detected a strong emission from a disk of gas orbiting around a central object in a distant galaxy. This radiation allowed scientists to measure velocities of gas atoms around the object. The velocity pattern they found can only be attributed to a black hole. Thus, that validates my contention that it was the math that identifies and has located this thing, this force, this entity known as a black hole. Are all black holes the same size? British physicist and mathematician Stephen Hawking, in his theoretical physics, whom I want you to know, I have challenged several times to come onto this program to discuss things with me. I've written several emails to his institution of higher education. I've forwarded emails directly to him and to his publicist to engage in that conversation. I have yet to receive a reply over these last 2 years. But Mr. Hawking says this: black holes were formed right after the Big Bang, the initial explosion in which the universe was formed. The basis for this prediction is the same conditions existed then as existed when a massive star collapses. In particular, there is a huge amount of mass in a very small area. It is possible that these mini black holes could be scattered throughout the universe. Can black holes ever be destroyed? It is again Stephen Hawking's theory about the evolution of black holes goes like this. Space, instead of being empty, is actually filled with virtual particles. Virtual particles cannot themselves be detected, but their presence is only known by their effect on other objects. These particles have two halves. One gets sucked into the black hole, while the other half, created from the black hole's mass, evaporates or radiates outward through the evaporation process. The black hole loses mass until many billions of years later, there is nothing left. Now you got to ask the question, what would happen if a large black hole evaporated in the way Stephen Hawking proposes it? Other scientists believe this: its complete evaporation would result in a huge explosion equal to a billion hydrogen bombs. It should be trillions of years, however, before any such event takes place. The allusion to that effect is that this universe that we live in happens over and over and over again. It is a cascading effect that replenishes itself each time over trillions of years that sufficient stars collapse on themselves, they replenish and become a new universe again. This is when science oversciences itself and becomes theater. It becomes the show. Science fiction. Since we know and can prove that the prevailing wisdom says that the universe is only 14 billion years of age, there isn't any evidence to suggest this evaporation effect because it has not yet happened. What we can say for sure is that the universe is far older than the 14 billion years that it was thought to be. Modern science today has confirmed and validated that the limitation of technology today can only capture light that existed 14 billion years ago. Technology, the telescopes of today are only able to see back light back that far. The reflected light back that far. But that the universe is significantly larger, thus light is that much farther away. It was the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, through the grace and blessing of his teacher, that great one, that supreme being, Master Fard Muhammad, who taught him, that allowed him to teach us that the universe from the Big Bang is 78 to 76 trillion years of age. But that God was present prior to that, only he did not move. Because his will was always present. It just was not active. As a baby in the womb is growing and gestating, a lot of times the mother will forget that the baby is there until he kicks the crap out of her. And then she realizes he's there. He decided to move. I want you to think on that as we begin to close out this segment of Not So Mad Science here on the Black Hole Radio Network. And I want to leave you with a reminder. And I'm going to keep leaving this reminder until we have sufficiently covered the subject. So I want to leave you with the question of how fast is the speed of light, and is that the ultimate speed limit of the universe?
In the beginning, there was darkness, and then, bang, giving birth to an endless expanding existence of time, space, and matter. Now, see further than we've ever imagined, beyond the limits of our existence, in a place we call the universe. Streaking through space, light is the fastest thing in the universe.
It could circle the Earth 7 times in 1 second.
As it reaches us across vast distances, it reveals the history of the cosmos.
We're able to look back in time.
Light travels at 186,000 miles per second. Its speed is an ultimate barrier. Nothing can go faster.
We have never, ever broken the speed limit.
But is the answer final? Will spaceships ever speed faster than light? Is it even worth trying?
To give up without trying is just giving up.
It can neither be touched nor felt. It is an abstract quantity of immense impact, the rate of motion at the very heart of all existence, the fundamental linchpin of the universe that we call light speed. Speed is in demand. The fastest people, vehicles, and technologies seem to crawl in a cosmos where light speed is king. More than king, the speed of light is the cornerstone on which the universe is built.
There's a famous saying in physics, which is that the speed of light is not just a good idea, it's the law.
The speed of light is one of the most important speed limits in the entire universe.
The speed of light, 186,000 miles per second, is just incredible. I mean, if light traveled in a circle around the Earth, it could circle the Earth 7 times in 1 second. That's an incredible speed.
That incredible speed is the first thing we encounter when confronting the phenomenon of light. To say it is fast is a colossal understatement.
It's amazing to me that when I talk on my cell phone, I can talk to somebody clear across the country, and I'm not really aware of any time lag. And that signal is going from my phone to a tower up to a satellite back down, and it seems instantaneous. So we really take for granted the speed of light could practically be infinite to us.
Physics professor Clifford Johnson of USC is an avid bike rider. Circling a track, he considers trying to cover the same 186,000 miles that light does in 1 second. He'll find, however, that his work will be cut out for him.
To travel the distance that light moves in just 1 second, it would take me 22 months on a bike moving at 12 miles an hour, cycling 24 hours a day.
But the speed of light, in relation to the speed of life, makes our world work in just the way we've come to expect.
One of the beneficial effects for humanity of having the speed of light be as fast as it is that what you see is what you get.
Light speed makes everyday experience virtually instantaneous. When the light bulb goes on, you see it right away. Anything that happens around you registers immediately. And certain experiences make it crystal clear that light travels faster than anything else, including sound.
One interesting consequence of the great speed with which light travels is that you see a flash of lightning essentially instantaneously, but you hear the thunder only later on.
But light speed has its limits when stacked up to a place as large as the universe.
We think that the speed of light is unimaginably fast on a human scale. However, in astronomical terms, it's actually kind of pokey.
And so it's ironic that when the Apollo spacecraft blasted into space, traveling at what seemed an amazing 25,000 miles per hour, the speed of light proved frustratingly slow when it came time to talk to astronauts 236,000 miles away on the lunar surface.
So when the astronauts were on the moon and people asked Neil Armstrong, "Hey, Neil, what's it like up there?" Several seconds went by between the question and Neil Armstrong's answer.
Neil, this is Houston radio, check over.
Hi, Roger. Houston, loud and clear.
Roger out.
Loud and clear, Houston.
Roger, Buzz.
And those several seconds were not because he was thinking about the answer, but rather because it took 1.3 seconds for the signal traveling at the speed of light to reach Neil from Mission Control, and another 1.3 seconds for his reply using radio waves to come back. And that's 2.6 seconds without even thinking.
Okay.
The 1.3 seconds it takes light to travel from the Earth to the Moon is pocket change compared to other celestial bodies. Light from the Sun, for instance, takes more than 8 minutes to get to the Earth.
If the Sun were to disappear right now, if the Sun were to suddenly vanish, it would take 8 minutes before we would even feel the shockwave and see the effect of a disappearing Sun.
The limits of light speed also make communicating with Earth's far-flung spacecraft a special challenge. It takes up to 44 minutes for signals to travel back and forth to the probes exploring Mars, more than 3 hours to Cassini at Saturn, and over 29 hours to Voyager 1, the most distant of all, now heading out of the solar system. Still, these distances are trivial on a cosmic scale. We can almost understand the 10 billion miles separating Earth from Voyager. But what's next? The nearest star is a red dwarf named Proxima Centauri, nearly 25 trillion miles away. That's 25 followed by 12 zeros.
I am often asked the question, how can you as astronomer really comprehend these vast distances, these huge numbers? And the answer is, I can't. The human brain really doesn't wrap itself around numbers that big. Occasionally, I actually write out how many zeros there are in kilometers from here to a galaxy, just to see how huge that number is. But in reality, of course, as astronomers, we would be spending all day writing zeros unless we came up with a better unit to use. And that's what a light year is. A light year is approximately 6 trillion miles. It's the distance that light travels in 1 year.
Using light years to describe distances opens up another dimension of light speed's character. Think of it. Sirius, the brightest star in the sky, is 8.6 light years away. That means we see it not as it is today, but as it was 8.6 years ago. We see the bright star Vega as it was 25 years ago, and the red supergiant Betelgeuse as it was 500 years ago.
It's a wonderful gift of nature that because it takes time to travel, we're able to look back in time. The further out we look in distance, the further back in time we look. We would have no idea what our cosmic history was if the speed of light traveled instantaneously.
Laura Danley is curator of the historic Griffith Observatory in Los Angeles. With light's ability to take us into the past, she's assembled a stack of photos that tell Lightspeed's story of the universe in snapshots, looking back in time to its beginning, more than 13 billion years ago, to the present day.
I'm putting together a scrapbook of the history of our family of galaxies, and it shows all the galaxies that we can see with our telescopes as far back as we can see with our telescopes.
Each photo in this album, then, shows something in the universe with a look-back time equivalent to its distance in light years. The famous Crab Nebula, 6,500 years ago. The galactic core, center of the Milky Way, 26,000 years ago. And the Andromeda Galaxy, our next-door neighbor, 2.5 million years ago. But practically yesterday on cosmic scale.
I love this cluster.
For almost 90% of the look-back time, the album is filled with common galaxies. Common, yes, but intriguingly diverse.
These two are colliding. You can see one going what appears to be right through the other. And there's a lot of drama in the way galaxies evolve and the way they interact with one another. So this one would be, it's only about 500 million light years away.
As Danley places each shot in the album, a bigger picture begins to emerge. Adult galaxies have been the main characters, evolving in all their variety for the past 12 billion years. But the cosmos also has its childhood photos, showing galaxies when the universe was a mere toddler.
These are actually very interesting galaxies at about 11 billion light years away. These compact galaxies are represent what might be a two and a half year old child, you know, just really learning how to walk.
But even these galaxies have their younger brothers and sisters. This spectacular shot shows a gravity lens, a cluster of galaxies 2.2 billion light years away that bends light, allowing us to see much further in space and time. The lens reveals a tiny speck identified as one of the earliest galaxies we can see, as it was 13 billion light years ago, still an infant in the evolving universe.
Galaxies, when they were babies, really don't have a lot of distinguishable features. They're kind of blobs. They don't really have a lot of structure.
The universe as a whole was something of a blob at the beginning of its life, too. What we see of that time are the first light waves in history, reaching us only now, 13.7 billion years after they flashed into existence. We see them in the picture of an afterglow from the Big Bang. And they are known today as the cosmic microwave background radiation.
The cosmic microwave background radiation is the most distant thing we can see. It is, in a sense, the picture of the baby upon delivery.
NASA's all-sky picture reveals a glow that is uniform everywhere we can see. The universe as it was in a cosmic moment after its birth. But here, our view comes to a sudden halt. What we can see of the universe is limited, not by the size or power of our instruments, but by the barrier of light speed itself. How can the fastest thing in the universe make us blind to the infinity of space? Knowing that light speed is 6 trillion miles per year gives us the light year, a convenient shorthand for talking about the huge distances in the universe. But it's just as important to understand that light speed at 6 trillion miles per year is an ironclad constant.
The speed of light is so constant that the universe actually changes everything so that you never see it going any other speed. So the speed of light really is the measuring stick of the entire universe.
In fact, the constancy of light speed results in an amazing tool for measuring distance in the vastness of space. The tool is called redshift. It happens as light between galaxies travels at a fixed speed. When the space between the galaxies expands, the light racing between them gets stretched, turning red in color.
As light goes from one galaxy to another, from a distant galaxy to our own, for example, that light gets stretched along with the stretching of space. And that causes intrinsically short wavelength light, like blue light, to gradually become long wavelength or redder light. That fundamentally is the cause of the redshift that we see in the spectra of galaxies.
How does the redshift turn into a way to measure distance? It's all because of an astonishing discovery made in 1926 at the Mount Wilson Observatory outside Los Angeles.
Being up here on Mount Wilson is always a thrill for me because it was actually right here at this location that our view of the universe entirely changed. It was here that Edwin Hubble found out the universe is expanding. And that was an amazing thing. He wasn't expecting it. Nobody thought that was the case. And it changed everything.
Seeing red shifts everywhere, Hubble found that all of the universe's galaxies were moving away from each other, which we now know is caused by the expansion of space itself. As seen from the Earth, a galaxy doesn't look like it's moving away, but we know that it is because its light is redshifted. A galaxy moving away at low speed has a slight redshift. A galaxy moving faster has a larger redshift. But Hubble found that those faster moving galaxies are also farther away. That meant the greater the redshift, the more distant the galaxy. By seeing how fast space is expanding and working the math backwards, cosmologists have been able to estimate the age of the universe. Combine that with light speed, and you have a major brain twister.
The universe is such a huge place that the light travel time really becomes important to us. We believe the universe began about 13.5 billion years ago. That means the farthest in any direction we can look is 13.5 billion light years. There hasn't been enough time for light to travel more than that.
It's called our light horizon, a sphere 13.5 billion light years in all directions, containing everything we can see. But that's where the brain twister comes in. Does space end there?
We have no reason to believe that the distance we can see is the entire size of the universe. In fact, it might be much bigger than that. It's just that with light travel time, that's all we can see. That's our horizon.
So consider this conundrum. Astronomers in a galaxy at one edge of our horizon can't possibly see any galaxies on the other edge of our horizon. But they can see galaxies 13.5 billion light years in the other direction. And so can astronomers at the edge of their horizon, and on, perhaps to infinity. As for astronomers on Earth, light speed has them trapped.
If we ask what is happening beyond our light horizon, we have to face the fact that the speed of light really is a barrier. We've never seen anything beyond our light horizon.
Can we take comfort in the fact that there is so much to see inside our horizon? This breathtaking shot is the Hubble Space Telescope's Ultra Deep Field. It's a massively detailed photo of an area of the sky 100 times smaller than the full moon, yet containing 10,000 galaxies, some whose light has been speeding toward us for 13 billion years. Beyond that is the cosmic background radiation from just 400,000 years after the Big Bang. In NASA's color-coded picture, the radiation's glow is pure green, representing a distribution of matter so uniform, its temperature varies no more than 1/50,000th of a degree. Nothing in human experience is even close to this kind of uniformity. In fact, astronomers believe the universe should really be very different.
By right, the universe should be lumpy. If you look in this direction and you look in that direction, you should see two entirely different concentrations of matter, different temperatures, but it's extremely uniform. Therefore, we have a puzzle.
The puzzle has its roots at the universe's birth in the Big Bang. If everything flew apart from the beginning, why shouldn't it be uniform?
No kind of an explosion that we know about leads to that kind of uniformity. If you imagine an ordinary explosion, an atomic bomb, a piece of TNT, it's not really uniform at all. There's a piece of shrapnel going off there, a piece of paper going off there, an extra piece of iron going off there. It's really very non-uniform.
So scientists believe the cosmic background radiation just shouldn't be as smooth a green as it is. We can find out why in an ordinary paint store.
Let's consider a universe that consists of different color cans of paint. In our hypothetical paint universe, we have a can of yellow paint and a can of blue paint. And at the instant of the Big Bang in this universe, the two cans of paint start expanding apart from each other. In our hypothetical paint universe, one side of it would look yellow, and the other side would look blue.
But as we've learned, the cosmos looks green, whether it's the paint universe or the real thing. The two colors of paint represent the different particles in the infant universe. To end up a uniform green, like the cosmic background radiation, they had to be touching. But when scientists first calculated the speed of the Big Bang, they concluded that it blew everything apart faster than the speed of light, meaning blue and yellow were too far apart, even at the instant of creation, for any mixing to take place.
Seeing a universe that's so uniformly green would be very strange. It would be like taking our can of yellow paint, pouring it out, and having it be green. Then taking the can of blue paint, pouring it out, and having it be green as well. It's impossible.
This horizon problem can be solved by a theory that I've worked on called inflation, which is a twist on the Big Bang.
Inflation is now the widely accepted variation that makes the Big Bang work without the limit imposed by the speed of light.
Another way this could have happened is that our paint universe might have expanded only this far. The two cans of paint have enough time to mix and become uniformly green before the universe undergoes a sudden period of expansion that occurs faster than the speed of light. This would spread green paint all over the universe.
If this theory is right, the period of inflation is really the Big Bang that we observe. The other bang that happened before that becomes really a little bang. It's just a precursor to the real Big Bang.
Even today, the universe is expanding at high velocity, galaxies speeding away from each other so fast that they seem to violate light speed as the ultimate speed limit. The faster-than-light expansion of space sets yet another limit on what we can see from Earth, where the galaxies of the universe continue to rush away from us.
The galaxies that are relatively near to us, those that you can see easily, are moving away pretty fast. And indeed, the more distant ones are moving away faster. But the ones that are really far away, in fact, are moving away faster than the speed of light. And then there are the galaxies that you will never see because they started out so far away that the light from them will never reach you because the space is expanding faster than the speed of light.
Space itself, then, is the exception to the rule. It can expand faster than the speed of light. But everything inside it remains bound by Albert Einstein and his theory of relativity.
Albert Einstein is the cop on the block. You cannot break the light barrier. We physicists can accelerate particles to 99.9999% the speed of light, but we have never, ever broken the speed limit.
But we don't need to break the limit to experience the strange province of light speed. If the universe bends and stretches around the speed of light, what happens when we hit the accelerator and start to get close?
And we're going to stop right there. This is Not So Mad Science, and I'm your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. It is now 4 minutes to the hour. We're going to close out this segment of Not So Mad Science, and we're going to leave with those immortal words of Adam Clayton Powell Jr., the third former pastor of the Abyssinian Baptist Church in New York City. Prayerfully wishing that I've said and shared no words that hurt anyone's feelings, but did invigorate the mind and your spirit to gain more insight into your singular relationship with God, and to know that He is a man and He is real and in you. To that end, keep the faith, baby. Keep the faith. Because we've entered into the Trumpian era. Keep the faith. There's a God and His Christ on the scene, and they are handling business. Keep the faith. Keep the faith. Assalamu alaikum. Thank you.